Thanks for joining us on Battle Walks as we walk across the great battlefields of Europe. If you're enjoying the show, why not become a member? Every week, you'll receive exclusive bonus episodes available only to subscribers, and you can listen to all our episodes completely ad-free. Click on the link in the show notes to join us via Acast Plus.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
I'm Matt McLaughlin.
And I'm Pete Smith.
We're battlefield historians who love nothing better than getting out and walking the ground where great battles in history took place.
And now we'd like you to come with us. Every week, Battle Walks will take you to one of the great battlefields of Europe.
As we walk the ground, we'll dig through the pages of history, we'll uncover the secrets of the battlefields, and most importantly, we'll tell the stories of the people who fought and died there.
Welcome to Battle Walks.
Hello everyone, welcome to Battle Walks. My name is Pete Smith, and today I'm recording one of my out and about podcasts, one of my favourites. So no Matt McLaughlin, my normal co-host. So where am I? Well, at the moment, it is rather noisy. I'm hoping that you're not picking up too much of the background. I'm sat at a small table in the corner of a bar in the centre of Cherbourg. My good friend and V1 expert, battlefield explorer Andrew Bellamy, is at the bar, hopefully getting me a drink. Very oddly, actually, he's talking to a fellow Australian barman, and I'm wondering if perhaps we'll get a discount on the beer. Who knows? Andrew and I have been on the trail of V1 sites, which is a fairly regular occurrence, and also anything else war-related that catches our attention when we're going from point to point. And that's what this is going to be about. It's a random cross section of the stuff that did catch our attention over the last 2 days. Andrew actually suggested the title Sat-Nav Diversions, because we tend to go from A to B using the sat-nav. I thought it was a good idea, as most of the things we found of interest were due to the vagaries of my rather slick-talking navigation system. So that's what we're doing today. So where do we start? So let's start with yesterday. Day one, the first unscheduled stop was in the village. Now, you'll have to excuse my pronunciation, those of you that have listened to me doing these podcasts before. Le Mesnil-Durand. Now, that was quite an easy pronunciation. Le Mesnil-Durand. And we spotted, as we travel through the village, the iconic green CWGC sign on the gate of the communal cemetery. Tomb de la Guerre du Commonwealth. So just the one grave, so tomb. Andrew and I have, I suppose, become astute at guessing based on the location where we are, what type of grave that it's going to be. And in this case, we both correctly assumed that it would be an airman, a 1944, because of where we are. Oddly, I'm never quite sure how I feel about these. Every time I go to one of these cemeteries and find an individual isolated grave, very often lie surrounded by an ever-changing landscape, oddly. New graves replacing old, dilapidated headstones, sometimes rusting ironwork. You often wonder, are they remembered by the local people? Are they commemorated? I think very often they are. I like to think so, and certainly the graves are cared for by the Commonwealth War Graves, so they're always looking fairly pristine. We do occasionally come across one that's not been forgotten, but perhaps not been visited recently, so I often do a little bit of weeding myself and cleaning up, which is always good to do. Anyway, in this case, the grave was Flight Lieutenant R.F. Bass, a pilot, Royal Air Force, 29th of June 1944, age 21. Well, what we normally do, and what we did in this case, normally pay our respects and then head back out to the car and out with the iPad. And quickly, while we're still there, while it's fresh, and you have a look at the details that we can discover about R.F. Bass. So in this case, very quickly, we found Reginald Frederick Bass, a Spitfire pilot, flying with 222 Natal Squadron, part of 135 Wing based in Selsey-Bill. And on the 29th of June, they were providing fighter cover over the D-Day beaches. And at 8:45, southwest of Lisso, they encountered a number of Focke Wulf 190s of JG-26. And Flight Lieutenant Bass, unfortunately, was shot down by Lieutenant William Hoffman, the officer commanding the 8th Staffel. I also found a marvellous photograph of this young man posing with his new aircraft. And in this case, the aircraft is named. It was Cuba Libre, one of two aircraft named and unveiled by the Cuban ambassador. I'll post all of these. There's going to be quite a few photographs that I'm going to post on the Battle Walks Facebook page as we travel along. So that was our first port of call. The actual what Andrew and I are actually doing is we're going to the V1 sites and following V1 sites. But this isn't a V1 podcast. We've already put out, for those that are interested, there is a podcast on V1 launch sites. But I thought I'd mention really some of the observations on some of these sites as well as some of our detours. So we were visiting a site. The next visit was a site near Castellon en Orgue. It's a modified site, so not the great concrete megastructures of the ski sites, but still quite some substantial concrete still there. And those are the smaller, solidly built structures, like the catapult cleaning and compressor buildings. And in this case, they were right beside the public road, so almost impossible to miss. And why I'm commenting upon it is what really caught my eye as we were having a look round. And one of the things was a China telephone insulation a pot insulation device. It's where you tie your telephone lines to for insulating them from other electrical cables. And it was still screwed into the ceiling. But what really I found I just found it interesting, really, is that the pencil mark was drawn into the concrete where you could see where the contractor who fitted it and screwed it into the wall had marked his little cross and then a line to show where the cables and where the insulator should go. Still there after all this time. And then out we went round the back of the building, and not common, but there was a series of very much Great War style zigzagging trenches, so defensive trenches. I suppose it's because we're in Normandy and near the coast, and so these things doubled up as defensive positions. So zigzagging trench behind the building, so I jumped into it and walked along it. And spilling out of one corner of it were a whole load of glass bottles. And oddly, a medical ampoule, I suppose. Not oddly, it's just they all had a slight medical usage, most of the bottles that were coming out. So for some reason, all contemporary, all from that Second World War period. So I had a good old rummage through them, and oddly, yes, I was a bottle collector in the past, so I know my old bottles, and I picked a few up and decided to leave them there. I don't really collect bottles any longer, and I thought I'd leave these for somebody else to look at and to find and get excited about. But just interesting what you can find when you're rummaging on these old sites. Again, I took a photograph of a couple of the bottles, so you can have a look at those on the Facebook page. And then off we went again, back in the car and trundling down these country lanes, following where the sat-nav was going to take us. And the final real unexpected find of the day was on top of a gentle rise and a hill between two villages, Mazières and Estrées-la-Campagne. possibly. And it was a white cross flanked by two black marble plaques with gold lettering. And the clue straight away, I knew what we were looking at. On top of the white cross was, I could see, a Canadian maple leaf. So, obviously, a Canadian memorial. So, park the car up just at the side of the road. Very often with these little memorials, there's nowhere to park. So, it's just a case of getting two wheels up on the bank. My car sometimes thinks it's a four-wheel drive. It's not, but I use it as if it was. Anyway, parked it up on the side of the road and emblazoned... on the just beside the cross, to the soldiers of the 28th Canadian Armoured Regiment, the British Columbia Regiment, Canadian Armoured Corps, and the, now I'm going to struggle with this word, Algonquin, I hope that's how you say it, Algonquin, I'm sure it isn't how you say it, Regiment, who on the 9th of August 1944, in the surrounding area of Hill 140, gave their lives for freedom. Greater love hath no man. So very moving inscription. And again, we paid our respects. We do normally carry a few little poppy crosses around with us and lay them where necessary and sometimes scribble a bit of information on them. So paid our respects and had a good look at the landscape. And one of the great things about doing this is you can look and try and understand why it's there without knowing anything about the action, because I have to say, knew nothing about the action, and visualising what was going on at that time. And then we got back in the car and onwards towards Cairns, which is going to be our first overnight stop. And I added it to the list of an ever-growing list of when you're on one of these tours of things to look up and find further information on when we got back to the hotel. So in the hotel that evening, a quick bit of research, and discovered that these guys were part of Worthington Force, and they'd been tasked during phase two of the Operation Turtle Eyes, which was to secure the high ground overlooking Falaise. And on this ground, around Hill 140, Worthington Force fought a desperate and stubborn engagement against a very determined enemy. Unfortunately, the hill that they had been tasked to take and hold was Hill 195, which was 7K to their east, so they were actually on the wrong location. And by 1700, most of Worthington Force had been captured or forced to withdraw. So it was a tough fight for them, and that's why they remember it. And I think the final line on the memorial, I always take lots of photographs so I can have a look at them and remind myself of what was going on. And the final line on their memorial, their courage and sacrifice remains unsurpassed in the annals of the Canadian Army. So you can see how it was, and probably still is viewed. So back to Cairns. So that's where we were for the first night, in the centre of Cairns. A very nice hotel. It's one that I use quite often. Described quite often as the gateway to Normandy and the landing beaches, or perhaps the gateway to the Normandy landing beaches, rather than Normandy, because we have been in Normandy for quite a while. It's the third largest city in Normandy, which quite surprised me. I thought it was the largest, but in fact, Le Havre, which I never really relate to being in Normandy, but Le Havre and Rouen are both larger and both within Normandy. Cairns, founded by William the Conqueror in the 11th century. We'll do this a bit, jump about to different periods in history. So, founded by William the Conqueror in the 11th century and became a major English stronghold in the Hundred Years' War. And again, we have covered a little bit of the Hundred Years' War in previous podcasts. We did Agincourt. And so you can look back to the podcast, have a look at the Agincourt podcast. The Chateau de Cairns, which is a castle, a fortification built in 1060, very badly damaged in 1944 during the heavy bombing of Cairns, because it wouldn't surrender, and when the Germans were holding it, so very heavily bombed by the Allies. But it's been beautifully restored and certainly well worth a visit. Orne River flows through the town along with the Cairns Canal, both of which are relative, for those who have done the Normandy beaches, will know that Pegasus Bridge crosses over the canal. Lots of hotels, again, to suit everyone's pocket. And it's great for shopping, if you like that kind of thing, which I don't. But it's... when you live in very rural France, it's sometimes nice to be in a town to go and actually wander amongst some shops, but not overly my thing. And of course, lots of bars and restaurants, which are excellent. I'm sure you get the drift. Nice place to use as your base if you're travelling. It's at one extreme end of the Normandy battlefields, but it you have to start somewhere. So I was like going to kind of like the city itself. So the following morning, we were up bright and early, and so that's today. That was this morning, and off we went from Caen to Cherbourg. That's our objective today. Whole list of V1 sites to go to, and again, but that's not what this podcast is going to be about. Even though we will mention them a little. First port of call, something that. Oddly, Andrew had been to, and I had not been to, and that was one of the WN positions, wind positions. This one wind 60 above Omaha Beach. WN is an abbreviation of Nest of Resistance, so basically they're strong points. Looking from a German perspective, so out to sea, it's on the extreme right of Omaha Beach, in an area known as Fox One Draw. A draw is one of the routes up that was going to be used to get up off the beaches. And unusually, it's not a location I had visited. It's one that Andrew had visited briefly and wants to go and have a look at again. And I have to say, I was completely blown away by it. What a fantastic sight. I hadn't been before because it can't be reached by large coaches, and it takes too long to walk there from the beach. You could come up from the beach, or in fact, actually approach it from the village. But we managed to drive there. Sadly, following the sat nav, it didn't quite take us the way that that I thought it was going to take me. It led us slightly astray, and we ended up navigating a pedestrian footpath at one point. But anyway, we got there. Just fantastic. So what is there to see for those of you that hopefully will visit it? And that's the whole point of these podcasts, to encourage people to get out and about and to do what we do. Probably the best view across Omaha Beach of any location. I certainly was just amazed by the view. You can look right along the beach, past the American Cemetery, all the way to Pont de Hoc. So you can see the whole spread of Omaha Beach. The site itself is a great little site. It's a cluster of Tobruks. Tobruks being 45 positions. They're like little kind of, how do I describe a Tobruk? It's a circular top or octagonal top sometimes, just about the size of two men. So if you imagine two men side by side, they are used for either mortar positions or very often machine gun positions, so both. And then the bulk of everything is under the ground. In fact, all of it's under the ground, so you've got storage for ammunition. And the men feeding the guns. So a cluster of those, an observation bunker and several gun platforms, and all accessible. You can go inside them, you can walk through them. So just fantastic. And so a great location to go to. A little bit of the history of the site. By 9 o'clock on the 6th of June, two companies of the American 16th Regiment 1st Infantry Division, so the big red one, had taken this site. So it's one of the earliest areas to be taken. And the defenders, 40 men of Grenadier Regiment 726, surrendered, 31 being taken prisoners of the 40. It's a well-photographed site, and in fact, what we did before we came here, so last night we actually went and found a load of photographs of the site, so well worth doing, and we're able to compare those while we stood about, so we got an understanding of how the emplacement worked. So, great site, highly recommend it. WN60, Fox One Draw, looking out to sea, extreme right of Omaha Beach. Go and track it down. So, back in the car, off we went again, and a couple of E1 sites, and then another sat-nav diversion. As most of you will be aware who've used sat-navs, they have a terrible habit of cutting corners, and in this case it tried to save us 10 minutes by cutting a little corner off the main road. and we just bumped into another a very interesting memorial. Flagpole, we could see it straight away. Again, Canadian, so the maple leaf flying, and a French inscription. No English on this one, just a French inscription. So here we go, give it my best shot. Le Mémoire de Joseph Campbell McPherson, pilot Canadien de la Royal Air Force, Abattu en ce lieu lors d'une mission de reconnaissance. Now, I had to check, see what it, I thought I knew what it meant, and it's a strange term if you do the direct literal translation, shot dead here during a reconnaissance mission. So, in fact, his plane crashed here, and this is where, sadly, he lost his life. 3rd of June, 1942.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So what form did the memorial take, or does the memorial take? Well, it's a large lump of rock, looks like granite, with a marble plaque fixed to the front of it with that inscription on it. Now, in this case, of course, this was earlier this morning, we did a quick look on the CWGC online database, and it tells me that Flight Sergeant McPherson was 28 years old, from Wawarta in Saskatchewan. Wawarta, does that sound right? Possibly. And he was a Spitfire pilot serving in number one photo reconnaissance unit. And he now lies in Cherbourg Communal Cemetery, which will be, in fact, the last of the visits of today. So it's the last place we went to. But more of that later. I'll tell you the story of visiting the cemetery later on. Again, I'm going to post. I tracked down a photograph of him, so I'll add that to the post. So back to the car. Now, this was very strange. Back to the car, 100 metres down the road, and we found ourselves travelling back in time massively. And there was a ruin sticking out of the ground just on our right-hand side, a obviously very old ruin, but very well cared for. And in fact, it's the Roman city of Aluna. And just these few structures visible, but enough to fire the imagination. And what we were looking at are the Roman baths, the remnants of the Roman baths, and all around us, theatre, forums, temples, all laid out in a grid pattern. Now under the fields, but there's quite a substantial area that's nicely lawned, and you can walk amongst them. The original town covered 45 hectares. Now, I'm getting this from the information panel that was there, and I'm not very good at visualising 45 hectares. What on earth is that like? So I did a quick Google search this evening before we came on air. And 1 hectare equals a rugby field. So 45 rugby fields. So that's the size of the town. 45 rugby fields. And it was once the capital of the Cotentin area, the peninsula. from the 1st to the 3rd century AD. So a fairly important Roman outpost. Now, the name of the town that it's abutted to is called Valogne, or Valognes. I have no idea. So, Valognes. I suspect they don't pronounce the S, so I'm going to go for Valogne. The name of the adjacent town, my view, fantastic job of preserving the ruins. They're well preserved. There's good car parking. There's good explanatory panels. And as you can see, because I got that information, all this information was straight off the panel. So, yeah, we don't just stop for the First and Second World War. We'll have a look at anything that's historic. And so back in the car again. Now, I found this amazing. It deserves quite a bit of conversation, I think, here. So, literally, a couple of kilometres along, and you get used to kind of your head screwing around all the time looking for things. And in this case, it's a little village of Tamerville. And screwed to the boundary wall of the village church was a big blue panel. And it was fairly obvious that it had aeroplanes, Second World War aeroplanes, in the text. And so immediately we pulled over and nice, easy to park again across to go and have a look at it. And the heading at the top, a tribute to our liberators in English. It's both in English and French, but a lot of English. So sometimes the French do have a little habit of abbreviating what they're going to tell us in English. But in this case, a full translation. And it lists four planes which crashed within the confines of the parish during 1944. Just find that amazing and very moving. And in fact, a close inspection of the plaque, there's no information as to who's put it up or why. So it's just a village thing. It's just the village wanted to commemorate. Somebody obviously in the village is keen on history, and he wanted to commemorate those that had died in 1944, fought and died, to liberate his village. So the four planes, as I mentioned, are a cross-section, really, of what was flying at the time. A Douglas A-20 Havoc, a Boeing B-17G Flying Fortress, Douglas C-47A Dakota Skytrain, and a North American F-6C Mustang. And the F-6C is the tactical reconnaissance version of the Mustang. So those were the four planes that crashed in the village. But the one that really caught my imagination is the imagination. Sorry, Andrew's just bringing my beer back. Thank you, Andrew. Was the Flying Fortress, which was of great interest because it had been attacking V1 and V2 locations, so it tied in with what we're actually here doing. So I'm just going to read what it actually said on there. On April the 28th, 1944, 106 Boeing B-17, 106, should I say, Boeing B-17 Flying Fortresses were scheduled to attack the giant German construction work at Sottovast. Which has in brackets a future launch site for the V2 rocket. Well, it actually wasn't, but it was part of the V1 complexes in the area. And it also states as well as two nearly completed V1 flying bomb launch sites in the village of Hardinvast. Weather conditions were, however, far from favourable, preventing the B-17 crews from identifying their targets, and most of the B-17s returned to the UK with their bombs. Only the commander of the 100th Bomb Group decided to attempt another run, but without changing his course nor his altitude of 21,000 feet, which is 6,400 metres. Does that sound right? Don't know. Don't think so. I think I'll stick to the feet, 21,000 feet. The German anti-aircraft gunners had seized their chance and started an intense barrage of fire. And they scattered the 21 B-17s during their second run. Although 15 planes managed to drop 90 bombs of £1,000 on the target, the planes were tracked by flak shells all the way, which eventually hit and shot down the lead plane. And the second one, which is the one that crashed over the village or exploded over the village, known as it's named the Denver Doll, belonging to the 349th Bomb Squadron, suffered the same fate when it received a direct hit on one of its engines, resulting in a fire. The plane was last seen diving and breaking up, the left wing detaching, before the plane disappeared, spinning into a thick cloud layer. The pilot had ordered the crew to bail out, but only three were able to open their parachutes before the plane exploded in the sky above Tamerville. The largest piece of the B-17 fell near Cantarine, and the three survivors were captured. The bodies of the seven deceased crew members were buried on May the 2nd, 1944, in Cherbourg Cemetery, but the American Graves Registration Service transferred their remains to the temporary military cemetery of Quaquabut in March of 1945, and two of the deceased crew now rest in the American cemetery at Colville, somewhere, so that's Omaha, while the five other crew members' remains were returned to the United States for burial. So just fascinating story, and connects very much with what we're actually doing, looking at the V1 and firing positions here. I just find it fascinating in this very, very rural village. You know, all this effort has been made in recording all of that information. There's actually some more information on there about the taking of the village and the men that actually worked in the village after the 6th of June when it was retaken, and the Americans that were in the area. So just lots of information. Sorry, it's going to take a mouthful of beer. Oh, that's better. Right. Onwards, we went back to V1 site, and I thought, again, I'm just going to bring in a little bit of V1 here. So what are we doing when we're looking at V1 sites? I'm sure some of you who have listened to the V1 podcast wonder and know that my hobby, and when Andrew is over from Australia, we spend a lot of time just driving around from V1 site to site. So what are we looking for? Well, what we're looking for is very often is something unusual that we haven't seen before, or perhaps a more complete component than we normally see on the V1 sites. And that's what we found here. We found something rather strange, to say the least, and it was at a place called Sossamesnil. Let's try that again. Sossamesnil. I should just make these names up and turn them into something easier. And we found a very odd V1 firing bunker. So it's beside the road, and it looked somewhat like a bush shelter. Now, the firing bunker is built to protect literally the people that fire the missile. And so it's normally very, very kind of tough, very thick concrete. This one, not at all. Bush shelter, long horizontal slit window facing the firing platform. So it was roughly in the right place. But it just didn't make sense to me. And Andrew and I just paced around it. We actually measure things quite often just to get the sizes. What was great is it was in perfect condition. And to be honest, it looked like it had been prefabricated and brought in. And that's an interesting kind of observation, because we often wonder how much of this, as they decrease the amount of concrete and try to make these things quicker. None of these fired, by the way. All of these in this area, none of them fired. They were all overrun before they could fire. So this one, almost certainly prefabricated elsewhere, this firing bunker brought in, but no way would it have kind of withstood the blast from a misfiring or detonating V1. It would have just blown it over. So it just didn't make sense to me. So we just marked it down as odd, and we moved on. Little did we know that literally 30 minutes later, the mystery will be quickly solved, because it's the same commune, and we're just visiting another firing point. Very often they are clustered together, so visiting another firing point beside the road again, and this time it was complete and it was buried. What we realised is that the one we'd been looking at had not, it just literally been brought. You can imagine, they lifted it off a lorry, they put it roughly where it was going to go, they went away, and they then abandoned the site. So it was never buried and literally put in position. So this one, perfectly buried, as it should be. So it was great to actually see one under construction almost, and very much being able to have a look at how it was brought in. So we learnt something, that they were kit formed, they were brought in, and they would be buried on site. So yeah, solve a little mystery. And it's nice when you can solve the mystery immediately. Again, I've got photographs of both of these, so if you're not getting the gist of what I'm talking about, then the photographs will help. So, onwards towards Cherbourg, and our last port of call. Now, this actually wasn't on the list, but I suspect it would have gone on the list either tomorrow morning, but in fact we decided to do it tonight. The light is improving, so it was still light beyond 5 o'clock. And we went to the cemetery, to the communal cemetery. The Commonwealth War Graves aspect is literally called that, Old Communal Cemetery, the CWGC section. But the CWGC section is within the bigger communal cemetery. Here we go again. And the cemetery is called Cimetière de Aiguillon Ancien. Now, I know what that ancien means. It means ancient. And cemetière is cemetery. And it's cemetery of the Aiguillons. What is an aiguillon? I've tried a direct translation. It comes up with something weird, so I've no idea. So if somebody wants to tell me what that actually means, that'd be fascinating. Anyway, the entrance is at the highest point, so you get the most spectacular views as you walk through. Two beautiful pillars that have mosaics on each side, and it's a black wreath with white. White streamers and on a gold background, just beautiful. And and immediately you're confronted by a sea of white painted cast iron grave markers, which are commemorating the last resting place of the French service personnel and of both world wars. And just fantastic. I know these type of markers, the cast iron ones, but you don't see them very often. I hadn't seen very many of them, so very interesting. And then amongst them, I could see the heavy dark stone markers of Belgium soldiers. So again, some Belgians buried here. And looking right across the grave to the right-hand side, across the cemetery, across the French graves, I could see the cross of sacrifice of the CWGC cemetery. So I knew where it was. And then this is where it all went horribly wrong. I intended to gallop across there and go and look. And I just found it fascinating looking at the French markers. There's a lot of information on these old-fashioned markers and names and nationalities and dates. And just very, very interesting. And immediately I could see there were Chinese, there were Serbs, the North Africans, sailors, Marines, soldiers, a real mix of the French military of the Great War, really, because the majority are Great War. I'm going to try and describe one of these markers. Again, I've got photographs so you can actually have a look, but it's just worth trying to describe them. On the Christian graves, it's like a sword, as in a sword in the stone. So it's a metal sword, and the words "Souvenir Français" on each side of the hilt. Then there's a lion's head, and the Croix de Guerre is also emblazoned on it. And then you get their individual names beneath that. So all laid out very well for the Muslim graves. And there are a good number of Muslim graves here. It's a tapering marker, cast iron again, Souvenir Français on the top. And then there's the star and the half moon. And their name beneath, and then the Croix de Guerre beneath that. So both very, very attractive. And I did spend quite some time, almost too late, because I wanted to do some photography down at the CWGC cemetery. But there was so much to look at, and the views are spectacular. The views across the landscape, and then so you're overlooking the town itself and out to sea. Spectacular. One of the best or nicest cemeteries, if there is such a thing, and I think there is. I enjoy going to both military and civil cemeteries, actually, but in this case, military cemeteries are then surrounded by a civil cemetery, but the military cemetery is the bit that we remained in. So across to the Commonwealth War Graves section, where the Cross of Sacrifice was, and we located the grave of Flight Sergeant McPherson, of course, the one that we wanted to go and see, having been to where he sadly lost his life and his plane crashed. So we paid our respects there and put a little cross there. And then I spent some time wandering up and down the rows of graves, and I photographed all the Australian and New Zealand airmen. All of them have been centralised here, so all of them died elsewhere and were brought here for burial after the war. And I sometimes have to analyse myself. Why did I do that? Why did I go up and down the rows just photographing the Australian and New Zealand headstones? Well, it's to do with distance. I mean, yes, a lot of the people listening to this podcast will be Australian. And I generally spend a lot of time with Australians. My partner's Australian. So there is a big Australian connection for me. But also I get this feel of distance. Whenever I see an Australian grave, I just think of distance. And has the family been to visit? Has anybody been to visit? And so I generally tend to take a record, a photograph. It's my way of paying my respects, really. And you know, I stop in front of the grave. I think about who it is that I'm photographing. I take a photograph of the grave, and I just keep them in my records. And I wonder if I'm the first to have visited, or if some family member or somebody else has visited. And then during my quiet periods, I don't get that many of them, but I try to carry out some random research. I look at a name and think, oh, I think I'm going to track down a little bit more information. So that's what I tend to do. And I photograph them all. And then my final visit, and this is just extraordinary. I could see a grave out. Not in the Commonwealth War Grave section. It's out in the French section. But it's a Commonwealth War Grave headstone, and I thought out amongst the French graves. And this is literally as I'm leaving, I wandered across to go and have a look at it. And this is whose grave it was. His number, PO 14590, Corporal, RMLI, Royal Marine Light Infantry, A.E. Reed, DSM, Distinguished Service Medal. HMS Stonecrop, 18th of September, 1917. So it's a First World War grave of a member of the Royal Marine Light Infantry. The PO is for Portsmouth, and why I was immediately moved is that I'm an ex-Royal Marine, and my number begins with PO as well, so we both have the same prefix to our numbers. It actually stands for Portsmouth. It's an enlistment. It's where you enlisted. So Portsmouth, PO. And I've literally done the research only about 20 minutes ago for this. I got back and I thought, well, it's okay recording him and saying, and paying my respects and thinking he's a fellow member of the Royal Marines. And I thought, I need to know a little bit more about him. And just fascinating. Just, I could feel a whole podcast kind of coming on just about this. So again, I've scribbled this down to make sure I get it right. So HMS Stonecrop was a Q-ship. Now, for those that don't know, Q-ships are basically civilian merchant ships that were armed very often with six-pounders or other more powerful guns hidden on the decks. And the whole idea was to try and entrap submarines. So a submarine would surface, which they very often did, to either sink the ship by shell fire or to fire torpedoes. And of course, because they believed they weren't armed, they felt confident to come up alongside them. And in this case, Q-ships were designed to trap the submarines. It had been a former collier called the Glenfoyle. And it was sunk. And it was sunk on the 18th of September in 1917. So the same date that Corporal Reed lost his life is when the ship was sunk. And it was sunk off the southwest coast of Ireland. So you have to presume that his body was washed up on the French coast somewhere eventually and was brought here to for burial. Interesting little bit of information. The previous day, it had actually sunk a German submarine itself, U-88, and that had been captained by Walter Schweiger. And he had captained previously the submarine which sank the Lusitania. So there's even a connection to the Lusitania here. So fascinating. So this Q-ship had sunk a submarine the day before it itself was sunk. So yeah, I can definitely feel a little bit more research coming on there. So I felt this was a fitting end to the day, and we went back to the hotel, and then here we are in the bar now, having a drink before we'll go and find somewhere to eat. So I hope you've kind of enjoyed this little ramble through some of the sat-nav diversions. This might in fact be part one of part two, because the next few days we're going to be doing more, so I may carry on and see what else I can find to chat about. Anyway, chat again soon. I wonder where my next beer is.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you would like to support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do it. Firstly, you can become a member. For a small monthly fee, you could subscribe to the show and listen to every episode ad-free and also receive exclusive episodes directly from Pete and I. So see the link in the show notes to sign up at Acast Plus and become a member of the show. Also, if you want to make a one-off contribution, you can now buy us a coffee. Visit buymeacoffee.com/battlewalks and you can make a small contribution there. See you next week.